And welcome to the Rick House. My name is Cyrus Farmer, and I am your host. This is the Stomp the Tea podcast, folks. We are back on terra firma here, just outside of Philadelphia, and we are here to bring you all sorts of information. Of course, we're going to be getting into the end of our trip to Japan. We actually started in Tokyo and ended in Kyoto before coming back to Kyoto and flying back to the U.S. on Christmas Day. And it is also the return of everyone's favorite segment, What Are You Drinking Tonight? But first, I did want to get a couple things off my chest as we start the show. Now look, I didn't get a chance to see a lot of NFL this last week and a half because I was in Japan and it was difficult to find a television or even I couldn't even stream the games on my phone in the middle of the night, audio-wise. Sirius didn't work overseas, at least not for me. But I do want to get a couple things addressed. First and foremost, kudos to the two teams who have done a tremendous job actually all season, one of whom has been great, the other of whom has literally been taken for granted all season long. Those two teams are the Detroit Lions, who did what they had to do this past weekend, as well as the Kansas City Chiefs, who continually just keep rolling along, just keep finding ways to win. They are a remarkable team, a remarkable organization, and they are going to be a handful come this postseason after clinching the number one seed. Now, I do want to talk a little bit of Eagles. Now, the Eagles, I believe, if Saquon Barkley, and I think you know how I feel about that acquisition this year, I think he's done a tremendous job. He's helped the team to an unbelievable amount. But here is the real test. With Jalen Hurts going to be missing another game, he missed most of the Washington game, and he's going to be out, essentially, for the game against the Cowboys this coming Sunday. So they're going to really have to lean on Saquon once again, because Kenny Pickett is going to be back there at quarterback. Now, I am all for Saquon breaking the all-time NFL rushing record in a season. That Eric Dickerson record, which, I mean, just goes to show you, it's not as easy as you think. Two or three guys have rushed for over 2,000 yards since Dickerson set that record, and none have come close to breaking that record. It just reminds you what a tremendous season that Eric Dickerson had. I think it was back in 1984, 84 or 86, one of the two. Either way, I'm all for Saquon trying to break that record, but not at the expense of getting either hurt or hampering the Eagles' opportunity or chance to get to and or win the Super Bowl. I believe there's two games left, and I believe that if Saquon doesn't go crazy against the Cowboys, if he's not within 110 yards of the rushing record going into week 18, they should sit him. The Eagles should sit him. Don't put him at risk. Get him ready because they're going to have to play the very next week. They're probably locked into the two seed at this point. So sit Saquon if he's not within shouting distance. And to me, shouting distance is 110 yards or less. If he's 120 yards away, 140 yards away, 150 yards away, I don't need him playing three quarters to try to get the rushing record. I really don't. I want to save him for the playoffs. I want to have him ready for the playoffs. I want to have him healthy for the playoffs because we're going to have Jalen coming back anyway, who's going to be coming back from injury himself with a concussion. And we need to have all things, pistons firing, so to speak. So there's that. Now, Saquon's not going to win the MVP of the league this year. That's the reason I would sit him. Now, you could say, well, how do you know that? I mean, if he gets the record, maybe he has a chance. He does not have a chance. He doesn't. The MVP this year is going to be either Lamar Jackson or Josh Allen. And they're the front runners. And they're the front runners for good reason. Look, if you want to toss Jared Goff, even Sam Darnold in there, on a long shot, Joe Burrow, because of the seasons they're having, you can discuss those guys, but they are not the front runners as far as anyone is concerned. It's either going to come down to Lamar Jackson or Josh Allen. And I thought this is going to be kind of an interesting time to kind of look at where both of those players are. Now, I have some notes here. Lamar, look, stats don't lie. They just don't. They are hard facts by definition. But by the same token, stats don't always tell the whole story. And I'm going to give you some stats, and I want you to see what you think about them. Now, Lamar leads Josh in every single one of these categories that I'm about to tell you about. Lamar has more passing yards, 3,955 to 3,549. He has a better yard per attempt average, 9.0 to 7.8. Lamar has a better completion percentage than Josh Allen this season, 67.9 to 63.8. Lamar has a better touchdown to interception ratio this season. He has 39 touchdowns to 4 interceptions. Josh Allen has 26 touchdowns to 6 interceptions. Lamar has a better quarterback, 121.6 to 101.2. 20-yard completions or more. Lamar has 53. Josh has 52. 40-yard completions or more. Lamar has 14. Josh has 10. Okay. Let's just think about that for a moment, because everyone speaks about Lamar Jackson as this running quarterback, which he does have the ability to run. I'm going to give you his stats in a moment there too. But just think about some of those passing stats that he's putting up this season, a year after coming off the MVP last season. He's had a tremendous stretch, again, in the Patrick Mahomes era, which is very, very difficult to do. So let's give him a little credit for that to begin with. The rushing stats between Lamar Jackson and Josh Allen. This season, Lamar, he beats Josh Allen on attempts, 130 to 92. Not that you want your quarterback running a ton, but he has more attempts. Yards. Lamar has 152 rushing yards this year to Josh Allen's 514. An average per rush, Lamar averages 6.6 yards per carry. Josh Allen averages 5.3 yards per carry. Now, the only statistical areas that Josh bests Lamar in are fumbles and fumbles lost. Josh has had 5 fumbles this season. He's lost 2. Lamar has had 10 fumbles this season, has lost 5. Josh Allen has been better in the area of sacks and yards lost because of sacks. Josh has been sacked 14 times this season and has lost 63 yards as a result of those sacks. Lamar has been sacked 23 times this season and lost a whopping 149 yards because of those sacks. And of course, Josh Allen has more rushing touchdowns this season, 11-4, 11-4 Lamar's far. Now, all those numbers I just read to you, those are facts. Those are facts for this season. And yet, Josh Allen's effect on his team's ability to win the game is undeniable. I mean, the guy is Superman. It's kind of crazy, considering what they lost, Buffalo, I'm saying. Considering what they lost on the offensive side of the ball, for them to have the record that they have, and for Josh to have performed the way that he's performed, is truly remarkable. That's why he's one of the 2 front runners for MVP. But I have to say also, it is so easy to take what Lamar is doing right now for granted. Again, I read you the passing stats. If I gave you those passing stats without having Lamar's name on them, most people will assume I was talking about Joe Burrow. I mean, his passing numbers are tremendous this season. They just are. Now, the one thing that you see a lot of other great quarterbacks do, which has kind of been the knock on Lamar, is that he doesn't bring his team back, right, when they're down? How many game-winning drives does Lamar have versus other quarterbacks in this era? And that's kind of, you know, that those two things along with his postseason record, those are the three knocks on Lamar Jackson as a quarterback. People think he's kind of a front runner and that he does, you know, he's great when he's winning, but you can't count on him to bring you back in the crunch. Well, I have some stats on that as well. And they found those interesting. Again, this is where stats don't lie, but they don't tell the whole story. Now, Josh Allen has 21 game-winning drives over the course of his career, 13 fourth-quarter comebacks. That's pretty good. It's up there all time in the list of numbers. I can't give you the actual numbers because I don't have them in front of me, but he's doing really well, and he's clearly the best of this era, just about. I haven't looked at Mahomes, but you figure it's Henry Mahomes. Now, Lamar Jackson, remember, Josh Allen has 21 game-winning drives and 13 fourth-quarter comebacks. Lamar Jackson has 12 game-winning drives and 10 fourth quarter comebacks. Okay? So you say, well, that's not very good. I mean, compared to Josh Allen, 21 game-winning drives versus 12 and 13 fourth quarter comebacks versus 10. That's not great. Well, here's where stats don't tell you the full story. I'm going to give you four quarterbacks who have more game-winning drives and fourth quarter comebacks than Lamar, but fewer than Josh Allen. And you tell me if you would take any of these four quarterbacks over Lamar Jackson. Quarterbacks are Carson Wentz, Marcus Mariota, Geno Smith, and Jameis Winston. Folks, be fair. I mean, stats don't lie, but they do not tell you the whole story. I think our expectation levels of who Lamar is as a quarterback, and coupled with the fact that he's had limited postseason success, has really kind of colored the way we view what he's doing these last couple of seasons. And what he's doing is absolutely remarkable. I think that Lamar has played a tougher schedule than Josh has played this season. And to be fair, Lamar beat Josh Allen in week four when they went head-to-head in a game that counted. So, even if it's a tie goes to the champ. At this point, if all things remain equal, I think Lamar Jackson is the MVP of this season to win his third and to go back-to-back, two in a row. Fascinating. Let me know what you think about that. By the way, I did get a chance to see the Beyonce performance on the halftime show of the Christmas night game. Well, it was, look, she's a professional. She's a tremendous performer. It was a great show. Grand in scale. Flawless in execution. She is just one of the all-timers. And well done, Beyonce. Great job by her. Great job by everyone involved. And let's give some kudos to Netflix as well. They were able to keep the whole thing streaming smoothly, which is probably not easy. Apparently, there were 27 million people at the height of the halftime show who were streaming worldwide. So well done, Netflix, but an even better job by Beyonce and her crew. All right, folks. Speaking of ties going to champions, I watched something last night. I watched the, instead of watching Thursday Night Football, Seahawks, Chicago Bears, I know you're thinking the same thing, right? You're like, Cy, how could you not watch that game? Well, I chose not to watch it. So, but instead, ESPN2 was doing a broadcast of the three Ali Frazier fights. Ali Frazier 1, which was called the Fight of the Century. Ali Frazier 2, which happened a couple years later, and then Ali Frazier 3, The Thriller in Manila. They broadcast all three. I got to tell you, I've seen two of those three fights before. I've seen the first one and I've seen the third one before. I've never seen the second one. So it was interesting to watch that and see what happened in between. But just seeing all three in a row was fantastic. Folks, I got to tell you, all three fights are tremendous fights. And if you know anything about boxing, we all know who Muhammad Ali is. We all know who, most of us know, he fought Joe Frazier in these tremendous battles. But when you watch the three fights, it's worth your time to go back and watch them, because you start to understand a little bit about who Muhammad Ali was as a fighter. Now, you have to remember, Ali, the first half of his career, like from 60 to 67, before he was stripped of his title, he's a baby. I mean, he's an absolute baby. He turns pro at 18, right after he wins the gold medal in the Olympics. So he's literally a baby when he starts his professional career. He wins the professional title. He wins the title from Sonny Liston at 22 years old. Obviously, I think at that point, he was the youngest heavyweight championship in the history of boxing. He was not a bruiser. Sonny Liston, if you don't know anything about Sonny Liston, Sonny Liston was basically Mike Tyson in his heyday with a mean streak. I mean, Sonny Liston was a bad, bad man. You did not want anything to do with Sonny Liston. Sonny Liston scared people to death getting into the ring. He scared people outside of the ring, Sonny Liston. So when you have Muhammad Ali, a 22-year-old, going in, as he says, I shocked the world, I shook up the world after he wins, it was a tremendous, tremendous victory. But you have to remember, throughout his entire first part of his career, for the most part, Ali was a dancer. He had tremendous hand speed. He had sneaky power, but he had tremendous hand speed and unbelievable elusiveness and footwork. Ali was one of the first boxers ever. In the past, boxers have always been trained to duck and to bob and weave to avoid getting hit. Ali was one of the first boxers, if not the first, to drop his hands when he wanted to get out of aware of a punch and to lean back instead of ducking or bobbing and weaving. Now, trainers always said in the past, you know, you don't want to lean back because it leaves you vulnerable to a follow-up hit. But Ali was so, he was so lithe and so quick and had such body control that leaning back was easier for him to avoid punches than it was to duck, bob, and weave. So, look, as good as he was in the first part of his career, and he was great, you have to remember, refused induction to the service for Vietnam War and loses 3.5 years of his prime. I guess he turns pro at 18 in 1960. And by 67, obviously, he's what, 7 plus 18? He's 25 years old. So he loses 3.5 years of his prime fighting ability before he goes back into the ring. Now, all that is great. But the reason Muhammad Ali is considered the greatest of all time is because of his boxing career in the 70s. After. He actually regains the ability to fight. And his title and boxing licenses were reinstated. Folks, I'm going to tell you something about Ali. Nobody knew when he came back in 1970 that Ali had the chin that he had. No one knew he had the heart that he had. Now, look. We remember, I didn't see this fight live, but I've read about it. The first fight against Liston, Ali apparently at a certain point, I think in the fourth or the sixth round, feels like there's an allegation that Liston put liniment on his gloves. to help blind Ali. So Ali fought at least a round or two with very impaired vision, wanted to quit because he couldn't see and his eyes were burning. But he didn't quit. Dundee didn't let him quit. And he ends up winning the fight after his eyes cleared. So that shows you quite a bit of heart to begin with. But no one knew that he had the kind of heart that he showed in the 70s. Folks, from 1971 to 1975, Muhammad Ali fought Joe Frazier 3 times, Ken Norton 2 times, and George Foreman 1. He was 4-2 in those 6 fights. 4-2. He got knocked down, but he always got back up. And he was able to find second and third and sometimes fourth wins in these bouts, in each of these bouts. He just showed tremendous will and tremendous tenacity and grit and toughness. To his detriment, you can argue. I mean, he had too good of a chin because he continued to fight well past his prime. And one could argue that his Parkinson's or whatever affliction that he had was contributed to by the amount of punches that he took and the punishment that he took. So I get that. But if you watch the 3 fights, Frazier, Ali Frazier 1, Ali Frazier 2, Ali Frazier 3, if you watch them in a row, and they're available on YouTube, please go watch them. You can just see the tremendous, the enormous amount of punishment both fighters take. I mean, if you look at the fights, each fighter could have won all 3 or lost all 3. I mean, the fights were that even. The fights were that close. If you look at the only fight Frazier won, which in some ways was the most important fight, the first one. If you look at Frazier after the fight and during the fight, he has swelling around his eyes, both eyes, tremendous degree. I mean, he literally, if you just look at the two, now Ali, his jaw, the right side of his jaw is swollen almost like a grapefruit because I think Frazier broke his jaw in that first fight. So they're both pretty beat up, but it looks like, you know, Ali probably won the fight if you just look at the two of them side by side. And you think about the fact that if you're Ali, again, now remember, I told you, he had sneaky power. If you're Ali, you start to, he always got it off to a fast start in all 3 fights against Frazier. But, you know, he's hitting Joe Frazier, punch, punch, combo, combo. And Frazier keeps eating punch after punch after punch to get inside, to keep boring into Ali, to get him up against the ropes and dish more body shots out, dish more left hooks out. If you're Ali, you have to be thinking at a certain point, every single fight, all 3 fights, what do I got to do to stop this guy? How do I get this guy off me? Because Ali is tagging him, especially early in all 3 fights. But Joe, to his credit, he's elusive enough with the bob and the weave, and he was just not going to be denied. He was going to take however many punches it took for him to take in order to get to Ali, to dish out punishment to Ali. So, I did want to mention that. Now, I want you guys to do yourselves a favor. Watch all 3 fights when you get a chance, if you're a boxing fan. Even if you're not a boxing fan. Each fight is about an hour by the time, you know, you get through it and this, that, the other. It's completely worth watching. If you're interested in why Muhammad Ali is considered to be the greatest of all time, watch those 3 fights. And also, I have an extra credit homework assignment for you, for those of you who are interested in extra credit. If you haven't seen it already, some of you have, some of you have not. But while you're watching those 3 fights, Ali Frazier 1, 2, and 3, do yourself a favor and also watch Foreman Frazier, which was the fight after, in between Ali 1 and 2, where Joe Frazier put his bout on the line against George Foreman. he of the grilling fame. And Foreman was a monster. He knocks Joe Frazier down 6 times in 2 rounds, wins the fight in 2 rounds, I mean, and wins the title. It's amazing. If you watch that fight, as quick as it is, I mean, you fear for Joe Frazier's health. You think he's going to die in the ring because of the power that George Foreman displays. So you want to watch that fight so you can put Frazier versus Ali into context. The other fight you want to watch, obviously, is Ali Foreman, the Rumble in the Jungle. This happened after Ali Foreman 2, Ali Frazier 2, before Ali Frazier 3. He fights George Foreman. Ali fights George Foreman, the Rumble in the Jungle, right after fighting Joe Frazier for the second time. And when you see what Foreman did to Joe Frazier, you will understand why Ali is considered the greatest of all time, because he unveils the rope-a-dope and knocks George Foreman out, which many thought was impossible because of the sheer power Foreman displayed. People feared for Ali's life in that fight before he got into it. They kept saying, champ, don't take this fight. You're going to get hurt. You're going to get hurt badly. And Ali unveils the rope-a-dope, which is a technique some of you may know, of the kind of leaning against the ropes, allowing your opponent to hit you while you cover up, hands over, fist over each eye, elbows tucked in to kind of protect your sides, and you let your opponent wail away on you as much or as little as they feel like through different parts of the fight, so that your opponent will, quote-unquote, punch themselves out. They will tire eventually, and you will be able to hit them at will because they can't keep their hands up anymore because they're too tired because of punching your arms. And that was the first time the rope-a-dope was used in the Rumble in the Jungle, that fight between Ali and Foreman. So do yourself a favor. Watch those fights. I think you'll really gain an appreciation for not only Ali, not only Foreman, but also for Frazier. Because when you see what Frazier, the beating Frazier took against George Foreman, to see how well he fights Ali all these times is unbelievable. And, you know, the two were great fighters, and it's one of the greatest rivalries in the history of sports. Now, folks, as always, I'd like to remind you to like, subscribe, tell your friends, tell your enemies, do anything that you would normally do to support any show, movie, podcast that you like. So please, tell your friends about us. Don't forget, you know, we have an audio version of this podcast. It's on Apple Podcasts. It's on Spotify. It's on, I believe, TuneIn. We're on a number of different platforms. So definitely make sure you subscribe and tell your friends about it. Fantastic content. Okay, on to the show, Kyoto. Folks, I have a confession to make. And I'm not ashamed to say this, but I think I'm in love. Yes, it's happened again. I fall in love very easily. Those of you who know me know this about me. But I fall in love very easily. But that does not diminish the fact that to me, it is still love. I love Japan. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, did I have a great time. Okay, so I'm there with the family, as you may or may not know. We're there about 9 days, about a week and a half. And I told you a little bit about Tokyo. So from Tokyo, we go to Kyoto. Very different vibe. Obviously, it's smaller than Tokyo. It's slower than Tokyo in some ways. But you can still find a crowd if you know where to look. But it is completely worth visiting. Now, some of the places we went to Gion, Ponchito, Fushimi, and downtown. We stayed in downtown Kyoto, which I believe is a neighborhood called Oikeidori, I believe. Now, the amazing thing about Tokyo is still amazing, about Kyoto, and I'm starting to think it's probably going to be amazing about Japan. There is so much shopping. Folks, there are shops, there are boutiques, there are stores, there are restaurants, there are bars. I mean, there's the retail factor in both Tokyo and Kyoto, two cities of incongruent sizes. And yet, the retail was unbelievable. There were so many places to buy things and to spend money. It was very, very impressive. I can't tell you how impressed I was. There was a mix in Kyoto. It's kind of a mix of, more so than in Tokyo, because Tokyo is, there's a mix in Tokyo also, but it's such a big city like New York. You can't help but have retail, residential, shops, boutiques, bars, restaurants. You can't help but have that mixed all together because of the size, sheer size of the city and the number of people who live in Tokyo. But it was the same way in Kyoto on a smaller scale. And I got to tell you, it reminded me a little bit of East Nashville, how like literally you can go to a bar and there's two houses and then three doors down, there's a cafe. I mean, like the residential was mixed with the retail and the boutique and the shops and the restaurants. It's all one big stew. And you have, you know, talk about a neighborhood bar. You have neighborhood tailors. You have neighborhood stores. You have neighborhood restaurants because they're dotted throughout all these residential areas. It's very, very impressive. And one of the other things is, not only is it a different vibe, it almost feels like in Kyoto, it almost feels like you're on a movie set. It looks like it and it feels like it because the old style of architecture is dotted throughout Kyoto. What you think of when you think of Japanese architecture, slope roofs, you know, the bamboo, you know, the rows that line every roof. That's dotted throughout the city of Kyoto. It is fascinating. And you're like, wow, did they just put this here for decoration? No, not only is that the style, but some of these houses, buildings, and homes are very, very old. So it's fascinating. Now, we had some tremendous meals when we were there, including probably one of the best meals I've had in years. We went to a place called Sushi, I think it was called Sushi Saeki, or Kyoto Saeki. It's a sushi restaurant. It's an omakase sushi restaurant. And they do a seating of 12 people per you know, dinner per night. And we were there, my wife and I were there. And had an unbelievable meal. I'm going to post some of the shots and some of the video from that meal. If you ever get a chance, downtown Kyoto, definitely go. It is worth every penny. I think the only meal that I've had that was as good, I won't say better or worse, but that was as good as Sushi Saeki was, I went to Daniel in New York, had a tremendous meal there, and Le Bernardin in New York. Unbelievable meal. But this Kyoto Saeki was just as good. I mean, it was unbelievable. And the host and the staff, they were fantastic. There was a Japanese description of everything you were eating, along with an English description of everything you were eating. Folks, if you ever get a chance, please go to this place. It was unbelievable. Sushi Saeki, or some people call it Kyoto Saeki. It was unbelievable. Now, I had a ton of sushi when I was there, a ton of onigiri. Had some ramen, not as much as I wanted to, but, you know, we had to make our choices. You know, I had onigiri almost every single morning before having breakfast, because I got up early, went for a walk. kind of check things out, and then join the family for breakfast and doing whatever we were going to do. Onigiri, that's one of those, they're triangle, like rice balls with filling, either tuna or seaweed or cod roe, something like that, wrapped in seaweed. So I had a ton of that. Even the supermarket sushi in Japan was good. It was, boy, I couldn't get enough. It was fantastic. Now, we saw a ton of temples, castles. We saw an Nishiki market. I believe I posted some of that on the social. Fascinating place. Along with so many other places. I mean, it's a great area and great country for history. History of all kinds. It's just tremendous. I also visited the Komoro Distillery. Now, folks, we talked about this distillery a couple episodes ago and last episode. Komoro is a new distillery. It's located in Komoro, Japan, which is a few stops away from, Karuizawa, which is kind of a resort town. It's about 90 miles away from Tokyo. A lot of the well-to-do, the well-heeled, the elite in Tokyo. Summer in Karuizawa. They're skiing, there's golf. It's kind of like a resort town. And Komoro is only about four or five subway stops, well, train stops from Karuizawa. This distillery, which we talked about before, is going to be releasing their first batch of product, I believe, in 2026. So it's just over 1 year away from release. Now, their first batch is going to be three-year-old whiskey. Now, you might be saying, Sai, 3 years old? Why would I want to drink something so young? Why would I want to drink a three-year-old whiskey? I'm going to tell you why. You have to remember, by law, Scotch, an Irish whiskey, only has to be aged 3 years to be called Scotch and Irish whiskey. Japanese whiskey follows the same model as Scotch. Now remember, you know, bourbon only needs to be 4 years old to be considered bourbon by law. So it's not as young as you think. It is young, but it's not as young as you think. It's kind of crazy because, you know, these guys, they're doing it the right way. They're not sourcing alcohol, putting their label on it, and waiting for their stuff to mature 2, 3, 4 years from now, and then switching out the liquor. No, they're waiting. They're actually aging their own stuff. The tremendous facilities. They have two pot stills. I did a tour. My man, Ian Chang, who is the co-founder and master blender there, took me on a personal tour, showed me the whole place. It was unbelievable. The facilities are great. And when you look at what they're doing and what they're trying to do, the reason you want to follow Komoro Whiskey and their distillery, their products, is because this is the birth of a brand. These guys, again, they're going to be putting out their first batch in 2026. That's going to be a three-year-old batch. They will then release expressions as they roll out and as they mature in age, eventually making the 12-year-old their standard. There is going to be nothing. Once you get past 12 years old, you won't be able to get the three-year-old. You won't be able to get the five-year-old. You won't be able to get the seven-year-old. However, they decide to mix it up. 12-year-old is going to be their standard. They're going to go up to 30, 35 years old as the juice matures. So you want to be a part of that. You want to find out how this thing grows, how it changes, because the aging process can do wonderful things to whiskey. If you have the right blender, if you have the right conditions, if you have the right distillate going in. So that, to me, is what's so exciting about what they're doing over there at Komoro Distillery. It's very, very, very cool. Now, the thing about their whiskey and their distillery is you can take tours. And folks, I can tell you, it's completely worth during a tour. Next time you are in Tokyo, go. Do. They offer tours. They have a bar. They have a gift shop. They offer food. They offer classes. It is completely worth doing because it's a day trip from Tokyo. The round trip is probably about 3 hours round trip. Going to cost you about $100, $120 round trip. That's taking a Shinkansen there on a local train from Karuizawa to Komuro. And their facility is gorgeous. And they are so good at what they do. The staff is incredibly knowledgeable. You're going to love the gift shop. Some of the things they have on offer are things you can't find anywhere. And because this is a new brand, you have the opportunity to actually get some things that most people are either unaware of or don't know about. Why am I talking so much about Komuro? I'll tell you why. I met Ian Chang at Whiskey Fest this past year in New York. He did a talk, and I got a chance to taste some of his expressions while they were aging. Now, these were his new make. They call it, which I thought was unbelievably genius, they call it newborns, their new make. They call their new make newborns because it hasn't aged into release maturity yet. So we were tasting this stuff at 1.5 years old. And I got to tell you, it had a tremendous amount of character for something so young. And it had more complexity than I thought I would expect from something so young. So that's why I'm so high on Komuro. Who knows what they're going to be? The 5-year-old may be way worse than the 3-year-old. The 10-year-old, you may like better than the 20. But I think they're going to have something that you want as soon as it gets released. And when it gets released, how many chances do you have to actually follow a brand, a label, a distillery from its birth, from its inception on the market to where it is 10, 20, 30 years from now? And most of you watching and listening, you're going to be around for the next 10, 20, 30 years. So why not jump on this Komuro distillery offerings now, before they come out, so you can grow with the company? If you don't like the stuff, you don't like the stuff. That's fine. But you want to follow them. You want to try them because this is a rare opportunity, in my opinion, a rare opportunity to kind of be there at the beginning of a label. What if you've been there when Elmer T. Lee was first released and you watch it grow and you watch it develop? Same thing with Pappy Van Winkle. I mean, what if you had the chance to do that? You would do that, right? I'm not saying Komuro is going to be producing Japanese whiskey at that level, but you never know. Maybe they're going to be better. Who knows? But what I tasted and what I had, I liked enough to actually buy in and follow them as they move forward towards release and beyond. Because you just don't get that many opportunities to do that. And I trust and believe in what Ian Chang and his group there is doing. And I think they're going to be putting out some tremendous products. So that is my opinion. I think you'd be well served to give them a shot as they head towards release. All right. So I have to say, the national drink in Japan, essentially, is the highball, which is essentially whiskey and soda. It's a cocktail. It's light, it's refreshing, it's easy, largely because of the proof. Most Japanese whiskeys are lower proof, 80 to 92, give or take, so on and so forth. So it's fantastic. I had a ton of highballs when I was there. I kind of used the highball as like an aperitif. I would have a highball when I wasn't drinking beer. I would have a highball before diving into some Japanese whiskey, which is kind of like a palate cleanser for me, an aperitif, a starter. And I was a tremendous fan. I'm going to start having him here. Now, I have to say, if you were to ask me, Kyoto or Tokyo, which do I prefer? I would probably give you a different answer depending on when you ask me. But if you're asking me right now, I have to say, I loved Tokyo. The hustle and bustle was fantastic. I mean, it is this big, brawling, sprawling metropolis, as I said before. There's so much you can get into there, and there's so much to do. But I have to say, the slower pace of Kyoto eventually ended up finding its way into my heart. I was really charmed by it. The big thing about Kyoto to me is you're so far away from Tokyo. I think it's about a 2.5 hour train ride. And that's on the Shinkansen, which is their bullet train. So it's a sizable distance away. And if you're like, well, I kind of want to be where the action is in Tokyo. But that doesn't mean that's the only place to be. I mean, I'm planning my next trip back to Japan, and I probably will not hit Tokyo outside of flying in and or out of it, simply because I want to explore so many other areas. Osaka, Hiroshima. Sapporo, Asahi. You know, there's so many other areas that I would love to actually kind of take into. Go to the north of the country where it snows much more. But I'm a big fan of Japan. I thought it was great. And I'm so glad we went there. I really, really enjoyed it. Now, a couple other items I want to talk to you about when it comes to Japan. Now, in general, I think Japan is a marvelous country. And we talked a few episodes ago about the people of St. Kitts and Nevis and my impressions of them and how I thought that they were a net plus to that country because of how they kind of comport themselves and how they're kind of boosters of the country and they know their history and they relay their history and they don't suffer fools and all those things, right? Well, in some ways, the Japanese people are very similar but different. There's no pointing or staring at quote-unquote foreigners. They're too busy living their lives to be worried about you. So they're just going about their day, trying to either make some money or live their life or do some combination of those two things. They're very helpful if you need help. Generally speaking, I think you can always run into a server or a subway operator or a taxi driver who just doesn't speak English and they can't help you, right? That's fine. If they can't help you, they can't help you. But generally speaking, I found that there was very little malice involved, at least in the instances that I was involved in. The schedule is very interesting in Japan. I mean, I would see kids going to school around 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, walking to school in the uniforms or not. But I would also see Japanese people going to breakfast at 9, 10 a.m. And these included like business people, men and women. Along with regular Japanese people, old and young adults. So it makes me wonder if their workday schedule is a little different than what we have here in the West. Maybe it's not always 9 to 5. Maybe it's something slightly different. You get hot towels everywhere. You know, like the sushi towel. You know, you go to a sushi restaurant, sometimes they'll give you a hot towel for you to rub your hands off. You can get hot towels everywhere. Even at bar, they'll give you a hot towel before you start drinking. And yet, very few napkins. It's very strange. Very, very, very few napkins. And the napkins they do have are very thin and very small in size. It is very, very unique, to say the least. Now, maybe we've been trying to figure this out. Maybe they don't give you napkins because you're supposed to be eating the food in a certain way, and I use chopsticks. I know my way around chopsticks. But if I'm having ramen or whatever, from time to time, I'm going to need to wipe or dab my mouth or my fingers or my hands. And good luck if you need a napkin to do that. You better hang on to the towel, either a disposable towel or the hot towel that they give you, because you can use that as a napkin to supplement the napkins that are not there. But we had some great food there. It was absolutely awesome. The Japanese public bathrooms, as you can imagine, like the subways and almost everything else in the country, are very clean, very usable, very efficient. I'm not saying you want to eat off the floor when you're there, but you have no hesitation in using any of the public facilities. They are tremendously clean. The malls are great. The boutiques are great. The drinking culture is fantastic. I mean, I didn't get a chance to make it to I think it's called an Ayuzaki, izakaya, which is kind of like a pub, like an after work pub, where you can get snacks and drinks, and it's kind of like a happy hour kind of place that people kind of go to unwind before going home. I didn't get a chance to do any of those, but the drinking culture really reminded me a lot of both Toronto and New Orleans, where people are just very, very comfortable and vibing. They enjoy letting their hair down without going crazy. It's just a nice part of life there, and I appreciated that. Now, we ended up in, when we came back, to Tokyo on Christmas Eve, because we had a Christmas Day flight out, and it was closer to the airport out of Tokyo. We ended up in Shinjuku. I believe I posted a Christmas Eve holiday wish video. We ended up in Shinjuku and Shibuya. And I can tell you right now, you can keep both of those neighborhoods. I was underwhelmed. I mean, the only thing that's impressive about either place is that the sheer number of people and tourists that inhabit and traverse those areas. I have a video I'll post in a couple days of, like, supposedly the busiest crossroad in the world in Shibuya. And I'll post that video and let you see kind of how busy it is. But outside of that, there's nothing impressive about either of those two neighborhoods. As much retail is there. You're better off going to Ginza, Shiodome, Roppongi Hills, Ikebukuro, Minato City, Harajuku, or Azabudai Hills instead. All those places. Those are all places I hit while I was in Tokyo, and they're all so much more interesting, in my opinion, than Shinjuku or Shibuya. So there is that. Vending machines. There's so many vending machines are everywhere, folks. You don't understand. I mean, I'm going to post a couple more pictures and videos of the vending machines. They're everywhere. You can get coffee, soft drinks, beer, fresh orange juice, cocktails in a can, ice cream bars, food. You can get anything out of a vending machine, and vending machines are everywhere in Japan. It is literally part of the culture. I have to look up why. I don't know why they're so pervasive. Everywhere you can find them. And they serve items that are hot and cold from the same vending machine. It is incredibly impressive, the technology. And these are not like new shiny machines. These are machines that have been around for a while, some of them. And they serve hot coffee in a can. They serve cold coffee in a can. It's unbelievable. It's very, very, very cool. We talked about breakfast and how sometimes the Japanese will eat lunch food for breakfast. Folks, it's fascinating. I can't tell you how many times I had breakfast in Japan and at 8:30, 9 a.m., I had a soup with my breakfast, or I had a club sandwich, or I had a ham and cheese sandwich. My son actually ordered pasta with red sauce at 9:45 in the morning at one of our breakfasts, along with other things. It is fascinating how the Japanese culture, the Japanese people, just eat what they want to eat when they want to eat it. It's awesome. Actually, I'm a big fan of that. Now, some of the best places to eat are spots, you know, you call these, if you were to be honest about it, you would call them like hole-in-the-wall spots. A lot of these places had these machines. I found this in a couple of ramen places that I went to. They have these machines where you put your money in, and some were had a touch screen. Some were just buttons, so high-tech, low-tech. And you place your order of what you want, you pay for it, and the machine gives you a ticket. And then you take that ticket to a server who's going to seat you. And then from there, you receive your food whenever it's ready. And again, we told you before, in Japan, our experience, the food comes out when it's ready. We had one meal, one out of, I don't know, 20, 30 meals, where all the food came out together. And that was at kind of a Western place. Everything else, whenever something was ready, it came out. And I have a video. I'm gonna post it for you guys. We got served by a robot. Our last night, Christmas Eve night in Tokyo. I'll show you the videos. Cute. But it's kind of amazing. You know, they you can do all this stuff in Japan. Now, the Shinkansen itself, it was very efficient. That's the bullet train. Very efficient, very fast, very clean. But you don't feel like you're traveling 200 miles an hour at times. You know what I mean? You don't have this, you know, you sit back taking off on an airplane. No, it feels very smooth. It's very efficient. And if you're on the Shinkansen, definitely make a point to book a green car when you get a chance, because they will bring you, it's essentially their version of first class, and they will bring you food and drink after you order and pay for it, after you order it, and you can pay for it in your seat. So you don't even have to go to a cafe car. It's awesome. Japanese subway, they're happy to help you if you open your mouth and ask for help. Same thing with the Japanese rail. You know, you got to ask. Sometimes, you know, people aren't going to kind of go out of their way to help you necessarily. But if you ask, most people in Japan will actually try to help you, which is great. I mean, we got a couple of, missed taps on our Suica cards, which is kind of like a metro pass card that you use to take the subways, and either booth attendants or Japanese rail staff helped us, you know, get through it, and they were great. But you do have to ask. You know, can't just throw your hands up, look up at the sky, and say, "Oh, won't someone help me?" Ask, and someone will help you. Now I went to this sushi place in what is it called? Ikebukuro, right? This place, they had zero English. I mean, none. None of the staff spoke English. Only two people on staff, the sushi chef and the waitress. None of the three other patrons spoke much English. The menu, all Japanese. But I'm here. I got a little time to kill. I want to try it out. Folks, the sushi was tremendous. Number one. That's number one. Number two, I struggled when I was there, because I do not speak Japanese. And I happen to know a couple of phrases, you know, ikura, uni, you know, and I ordered, of course, salmon and tuna, toro, right? And so they got me started, and a beer, of course. So they got me started with that. But the crowd kind of warmed up a little bit when I finally took out my phone and used Google Translate, which obviously almost everyone else and their mother would do right away. I didn't think to do that until about 10 minutes in, but I did that. But what warmed the crowd up is that I asked one of the guys who was kind of giving me a hard time, it's American, basically, but he was saying it in Japanese and among who knows what else. I asked him on Google Translate, I said, Shohei Ohtani or Ichiro Suzuki? Who do you like better? And this guy, this was the same case in both Tokyo and Kyoto, small sample size, but I asked about four or five people, and they all came back with the same answer. Ichiro Suzuki. They said, Ohtani's great, but not yet. He's not Ichiro. And I happen to agree. Ichiro was a tremendous player. We all forget how great he was. And which reminds me, I was a big fan of Ichiro when he was playing. Because you're reminding me of one of my favorite players of all time, Mr. Ricky Henderson. So rest in peace, Ricky Henderson. Rest in peace, Greg Gumbel. But I was fascinated to hear how many people, small sample size, gave Ichiro love over Shohei Ohtani, the flavor of the month. So there was that. And again, that sushi was fantastic. Now, you can buy whiskey and scotch and Irish whiskey from all over the world in Japan. But I have to tell you, I was a little surprised that Blanton's was so available. I mean, it literally took me off guard. I mean, it was so available, I actually didn't end up buying any Blanton's because it felt, honestly, too available. I mean, it was in every single liquor store I went to. Sometimes it was $25, sometimes it was $85, but it was all over the place. And you could see it in every bar. I don't know how much they were charging in the bars, but whatever they were charging in the liquor store was going to be cheaper than you can get it for in a bar. And even in the bar, it was going to be pretty reasonable. It's not like $100 a shot. There's other things they offer in Japan that they price up more. But I did decide to buy a couple of other things. I bought a lot of Japanese whiskey. I'll post a picture on that online. And I bought a Fortaleza Añejo and a Fortaleza Reposado, because Fortaleza tequila has been impossible to find. I started drinking Fortaleza, probably back in 2010, so about 14, 15 years ago. And I remember I thought it first came out like 14, 15 years ago, but I know that's when I was introduced to it. And it used to be everywhere. It was a little expensive, you know, $45, $65 a bottle. But it's still great tequila, a great sipping tequila, and different than, you know, Patron or Shinako or Casamigos. But nowadays, you can't find it in the U.S. So I bought a bottle of each of those. So I want to do that. And also some Japanese whiskey. So that is our trip to Japan. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you found that informative. I know that I did, especially having lived it. Now, this is the moment in the show where I get to ask you all my favorite question. What are you drinking tonight? Well, I can tell you what I'm drinking. And that is the Stillhaven Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. 5-year-old. Folks, I'm going to give you some information about this, and then I'm going to give you my opinion on what I think about this. Then we'll wrap it up. 44% ABV. It is distilled by the Barton 1792 Distillery in Bardstown, Kentucky. But it is bottled by Clear Spring Distilling Company in Louisville, Kentucky. That is the information that you get from the label on the bottle. It is 5 years old. Costs about $32 a bottle. Folks, I have to tell you, it is difficult to find some information on Stillhaven 5-year-old Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. Very difficult. Couldn't find a mash bill. Couldn't find much information about it at all. What do I think of it? It's okay. For $32 a bottle, it's not bad. It's not going to hurt you. It's kind of light. This is something I would not drink straight. I would drink it in a highball or a cocktail. It's a great, especially for that price, it's a great, great, great bourbon mixture. Cocktail bourbon. I still drink Elijah Craig, which is pretty reasonable as well. But I think Elijah Craig has more flavor and has a greater depth of flavor and more complexity. This Stillhaven, it's okay. It doesn't hurt you, but it's not the end of the world. So that is the show for tonight, folks. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for watching. And we are going to be back at you and then on a normal schedule next Thursday with a new episode with brand new content. Thanks again so much for watching. Thanks again so much for listening. And as always, we will see you on the first date.